Kenzie.
Lamar.
Look at that. We nailed it. Wow. All of our Irish fans are like, wow, they did one for me. You're welcome. Or they're really angry. We are covering The Boondock Saints today, a movie which 15, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old Lamar fucking loved. Might have been
36-year-old Mackenzie loves.
Yeah. 40-year-old Lamar has some feelings, but I still really enjoy it. So we'll get that out of the way real quick. But sometimes when you watch these movies from 25 years ago, there's some stuff that does not age well. And I figure we would just knock that all out up front so we don't have to worry about peppering it in throughout. So I'm going to give you a few topics of discussion and let's talk through really fast. Has this aged poorly? Does it make sense within the context of the film? Or is it something that actually isn't that bad when you look up back on it, which I don't know if that last one's going to apply to any of these, but let's get into it. Okay.
For sure. Let's do it.
Racial slurs. When you watch this movie, we're going right in hot with like, let's knock
this
one.
He's like 0 to 100 right now.
Okay. We're in Boston, Irish culture, like not knocking anybody, but there's, and Italian culture as well. There's a, some racial slurs in this. Do you think they make sense within the context of the movie, or is it something you watched and sort of cringed upon rewatch now?
I mean, I definitely cringe hearing.
Yeah, it can
them,
be both. Yeah.
For sure. But I think they make sense in the context. They make sense at the time. Like this, also the communities that we're in would very likely use this language. It's funny. It happens multiple times where you can tell even the people are struggling with the slurs in real time at that time. So I think they, I think they handled them well in that way. They're, I mean, I hate them all, but I think they make sense in the film.
Yeah, for the most part, I feel like in this, it's the villains, the bad guys who are using them. And even Rocco, the one time he does, it's sort
he's
of
like,
under threat
he's
of violence.
Uncomfortable. Yeah.
And there are a couple. I know the Irish brothers do use an Italian slur against Rocco at one point, and Rocco uses a Irish slur against them, and they're buddy-buddy.
They're also
buddy,
in a fight at that time, and, you know, whatever. It's, yeah. I agree.
Okay, let's keep working our way through. That's one out of the way, one out of like
I mean,
five.
We started at the top. I feel like we're it can only get better, right?
Okay, we also have some homophobic slurs from different characters. How do you feel about this one? Like when you watch it, obviously we cringe, but does it make sense in the context?
I don't like that it is used in multiple ways. Like it's in some things it does feel conversational. It feels like it's acceptable in this particular context to say it. I mean, probably culturally in the police force and at that time and the rampant homophobia, it was probably really accurate and prevalent. So in that sense, it makes sense. I think where you see it used later in a couple of times where it's somebody who is a homosexual using homophobic language, that's really challenging to see and hear. And you see that on the other side of that. But again, like, I feel like they deal with that in real time. Like there are other people reacting to his use of those words and having a problem with it.
That's so, yeah, it is absolutely your prerogative. Straight people like myself, I don't get to have an opinion about this. Honestly, I can tell you how it makes me feel. But within, you know, the LGBTQ plus community, there are folks who I know folks who use those terms amongst their friends because they are, you know, quote unquote, allowed to say them. I know other people who would hate it if they heard another person in that community use those terms. So I totally up to those folks, you know, how they feel about this. I felt it was interesting to have the homosexual character using them because it kind of does make you question of like, how am I supposed to react to this in 2025? But it's also, I don't love that it's played for jokes in both cases of, look, he said something offensive and other gay men are offended by the fact that he used this. And it kind of confuses you a little bit. So I don't love that it's used as a punchline throughout, but I do like the relationships that develop. And we'll get more into that when we get into the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we're going to have a lot more commentary around that with that specific character, because I think it is meant to inform a lot about this guy and his own psychology. And while it is very uncomfortable to hear, it's a part of that character. I think it's intentionally a part of that character.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. How do you feel about fuckass? Because I feel like this was a day and age, the 90s especially, were just, you look at what pop culture was at the time, and with Jerry Springer and with wrestling, like WWE being as over the top and just pushing boundaries of really like what's no longer acceptable socially. But I feel like the 90s were a time where we were throwing things at the wall. And you look at movies like There's Something About Mary and movies that are making fun of mental challenges and things of that nature and physical defects. And that's, I think this one, even though I still laugh at the character when I watch it, this one is something I do not feel you would make a movie these days and be like, we're going to have a character with Tourette's and it's going to be a punchline throughout the film. I don't know. What do you think?
I had a very close family friend who was like an uncle to me who had Tourette's. And what I will say is that it's relatively accurate as far as the physicality, like the way that he portrays it feels pretty, in my experience, in the person that I was close with, but they didn't have the expletive aspect of it. It was the physicality, and the expletive piece I know people have that experience. I know people with Tourette's who do like that. That is a somewhat common experience. I think that's the part that's played for laughs that I don't love.
Yeah,
because I don't think it's consistent across the experiences of people with Tourette's. And I think it's intentionally supposed to be a joke, right? Like there's absolutely. Other like stand-up comics who do things about that where they're like, why is it that people with Tourette's never say something like angels, butterflies, like something cute, right? And it's funny, quote unquote, that they say some curse word or something like that. That's the part that I don't like about it, that it's paid for laughs. I think it's totally fine. And I think it's almost a good thing to have visibility of characters with things like Tourette's and various other things. I think it's great to show it. Yeah. I don't like that it's played for laughs. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a line you have to walk when you're talking about, oh, we're going to have representation. We're going to address this within a film, but to make it a purely punchline thing is not obviously okay. We talked about a little bit, for some reason, I'm getting flashbacks of Muppet Treasure Island, which is a weird one to connect to Boondock Saints. But in that there's the blind character at the beginning and it's completely played for laughs. This person can't see it, or this puppet can't see. Look at how hilarious this is. And I have a blind sister. So obviously that's going to kind of touch a nerve for me, but it's like, I can still have a laugh at that because I feel like my sister would also laugh at that within the context of the film. But again, everyone is allowed to have their own opinions. Mackenzie and I are not telling you how to feel about this. Just, I thought that would be an interesting way to open up the show
and give you a preview of what you're going to hear later.
Wait, are we going to use all those words? That's kind of fucking, Mackenzie, we are not going there.
We're not using the words. We're going to reference that they are said, but we're not going to use them, just to be clear.
Well, yes. That's a fucking relief. Okay.
All right. Well, also the one thing I was going to add on is we showed up in our best Irish, you know, you're all green. And I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do the cute Irish today. This is Stitch. For those of you who don't know, I love Stitch. I'm obsessed.
And I love the New Jersey Devils, even though they're playing like shit right now, but I'm going to rock my Devils jersey and hopefully this episode gives them some good luck.
Loyalists. I like it. All right, let's roll. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are continuing Action April with
an exclamation point between the words.
An exclamation point.
You have to specify that every time.
I do. And it's going to be on every single episode when we publish it. Don't worry. I'm very excited. And we're continuing with one that we are super excited about, both of us. The Boondock Saints.
Which I feel like some people would say, you're doing a month of action. You're doing a movie from 1999 and you're not doing The Matrix. But we have mentioned this movie so many times in passing through the pod. I was honestly shocked to hear that you really enjoy. I don't know why. I did not peg you as a Boondock Saints fan, but it's come up a couple times. So obsessed. I think it makes sense to do this because we're going to do The Matrix at some point. There will be plenty of months that make sense for The Matrix. Boondock Saints, a little harder outside of March to find a month that makes sense for it, right?
Yeah, and I think like Matrix is low-hanging fruit. I feel like this is one that we don't talk about. Well, not we, but like the collective people don't talk about enough, even though it's pretty much a word of mouth famous film. I almost forget about it. And every time I watch it, I enjoy it so much. It's such a great one. So anyway, we'll get into my fangirling of this. Again, I think I said it in our last episode. I like action movies. Like I really enjoy action movies and this is one of them for sure. But what are we drinking to get through this? We were very on theme this week.
Oh, so on theme, and to the point that we did two different drinks. So mm-hmm. eagle-eyed viewers will notice that both the brothers in this have tattoos on their trigger fingers.
Eagle-eyed.
yes, you really, it's sort of an Easter egg kind of hidden in there for you guys, but Veritas and Equitas. So I did Equitas on my end, which means justice. And what I did was, this is 2 ounces. It's kind of a spin on a Moscow mule, but we're calling it an Irish mule. But it's 2 ounces of Irish whiskey. And I actually have to thank Janelle's friend, Kaylee, who I guess is my friend now too. Kaylee recommended this Irish whiskey called Shanky's Whip that I had never heard of before. And it is unique. It's a little lower ABV, which I know some people will scoff at. It's like 30% instead of 40, but they add some flavoring in it. I'm sorry. They add some flavoring into it of kind of like caramel and vanilla notes in the whiskey. So you can drink it straight, but I'm using that today. Highly recommend it for whiskey fans, just for something different on your shelf. So 2 ounces of that, 0.75 ounces of lime, and then topping it off with ginger beer. And obviously you got to have it in the copper mug, but this is Equitas. So what did you end up doing for Veritas, Mackenzie? What'd you mix
up? Veritas, if you didn't know, means truth. And I thought, what is the truth for the Irish? And that would be Guinness.
Oh, so you mixed up a Guinness. Wow.
Just straight up Guinness in a beautiful glass. We're Guinnessing it up. And fun fact, I found, totally at random, unrelated to this, there was a video in my algorithm, I guess it's psychic, a few days ago, about how to pour the perfect
I was gonna
Guinness
say you, that is such a good looking pour you have there with like the head
it
on
is
there
a mm-hmm. perfect pour. It's beautiful, and I learned it from an Irish guy on fucking Instagram. So anyway, cheers. Fun. Oh, I do love Guinness. I don't have it enough because you know, you actually don't find it on tap here a lot. And then also I don't really think about it even when you do. But also I had it in Ireland, and it's just so good.
I think the other benefit of Guinness, because I'm not a huge beer drinker. I was for a couple of years, and it just resulted in a lot of weight gain for me. So I had to stop. But yeah. Guinness actually, I think, is a relatively low calorie count compared to a lot of beers. You would think it's a dark beer. It's got a ton of calories. But I think compared to others, not that
it's
bad.
A lighter drink than you think it is, too. Yes. Like it looks, I mean, there are a lot of stouts and things that are like you're fucking chewing them and you feel like you've gained 3 pounds when you're done. This Guinness is not that. If you're not a Guinness person, and you think you won't like Guinness because it's like a stout, actually give it a shot, because it's a way lighter drinking experience than you think it's gonna be. So okay, let's fucking go.
I'm so excited
me too. The Boondock Saints, 1999. We are like, y'all, we're just going in. So let me just, spoiler warning, turn around, don't drown, it's spoiler time. It's been 26 years, you've had time to watch it, and if you haven't watched it, I don't know what the fuck you're doing.
And you should watch if you're an action fan. I also wrote down, one of my first notes was, it's almost better when you start this to pretend that it's a superhero movie, because there's this silly shot at the beginning of the brothers walking out of the church and they're matching. It's like, I never wanted to wear the same clothing as my brother. That was such a weird thing, that they got the sunglasses and they both light up their cigarettes and they have their matching little cute tattoos and their trench coats. And it's just, I'm like, this, watching it as a superhero style film makes it a lot more palatable for the first 5 or 10 minutes.
Wait, remind me, is your brother older or younger?
He's younger.
Yeah. That's what I thought. See, it's the older sibling shit where you don't like to match, because my mom matched my sister and I all the time, and I fucking loved it. Like, I didn't ask for it, but I loved it. I was like, where are we matching?
Got to feel cool.
And
yeah,
so love, cute.
Yeah.
And my sister fucking hated it. There's so many pictures of her having to match right next to me where she's like, oh my God, not again. So it's an older sibling thing. We loved it. So anyways. Okay. So very, very well received on IMDb, 7.6 out of 10. Not as much for critics on Rotten Tomatoes. We got a solid 26%.
And that's the people in recent years have really started hating on this, I think, because they know it was so popular. I was in college. I think I saw it for the first time in college. It came out 3 years before I got to college, but watched it for the first time then. And it was such a cornerstone of every, especially men. All the dudes I knew fucking loved Boondock Saints, and a lot of the girls in our friend circle too. And it just got this bad rap. I feel like The Departed gets that too, where it's like, oh, that's a bro movie. Like, only dudes like that. And clearly that's not the case. But it just feels like in recent years, people are critiquing the shit out of this, and it's still pretty damn good.
You know, here's what I'll say. I do think that there are things that are bro movies, and this is fucking one of them.
Yeah.
But it's still a fucking great time. There's a lot of us who love them. Like, I mean, is it going to pass, to your point, the Bechdel test, like we talked about the other day? No, but it's still, you can still watch an action flick that's a bro flick, and they are not all done well. Don't get me wrong. I do not like them all, but this is one that I think is very well done, and audiences agreed, 91% from audiences here. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that it's very well received by and large. But we'll get into some details of how it slowly became so popular. But the director, writer, slash band for this film is Mr. Troy Duffy, who this was, if you didn't know, his debut and only one of three films that he has done, one of which is the sequel to this. And the other one he didn't direct, he just wrote it as well. So I wanted to share a quote about this, though, because I thought it was an interesting call out from him. He said, "I wrote Boondock in three sections. I wrote the very beginning, and then I started thinking of cool shit for the middle. Then somehow between the beginning and the middle, the ending dictated itself." So yeah, if that's not bro-y, like, I just wanted to make a fun action bro flick. I don't know what is, yeah, but I just thought cool that was hilarious. I just thought of some cool shit.
Now, have you ever seen the documentary about him called Overnight?
No, I did want to bring that up, though. Yeah, so, I mean, as I said, this is only one of three. He didn't do a lot else. There's some production stuff potentially that contributed to that. But he is, yeah, the subject of a documentary, Overnight, to, like, go into all that. And I was very curious, but I did not get time to watch it before. I wanted to, but I didn't. Have you seen it?
I have. You can honestly... If you're interested in him as a person and seeing sort of how big of an arrogant douchebag he was and watching that for 90 minutes, it's worth watching it. You can get the same knowledge from just looking at the Wikipedia page that kind of summarizes how this guy undid all the good stuff that was in front of him. He, to his credit, he's 26 when he's writing this screenplay. He gets this inspiration. Apparently him and his brother lived in sort of like a drug house, and they just saw a lot of this stuff and had this thought of, somebody needs to clean this place up. Like, wouldn't it be cool if there were these guys that would just like kill all
the drug dealers?
Supposedly
it was like a dead body that got rolled out in front of them, and they were like, holy shit, like, somebody needs to do something about this.
Yeah. They saw a dead body, and they saw somebody just pick the pockets with zero remorse of just robbing a dead body and moving on, not reporting it to the cops. And yeah, just thought about that concept of cleaning up the scumbags, basically. So he's 26 writing this. I think a buddy of his took it and kind of passed it around Hollywood, and it got into the hands of the Weinsteins, canceled, piece of shit. Terrible. Harvey Weinstein sucks.
You can't see me, but I'm flipping him off.
Yeah. Just in the context of this story, he got it financed and they were going to give him a ton of money. They agreed to let his band do the soundtrack. They agreed to let him direct for the first time. All this stuff.
And pay him a writer fee and all the things.
Everything. And he just was such a prick to everyone involved. And he was this tough Boston Irish guy. He was threatening people. He was insulting actors. He called Keanu Reeves a hack when he was considered for this. He called Ethan Hawke a fucking punk. He is just turning everybody off around him. And almost everything that he had was lost because they pulled their funding from it. I think after he threatened Ewan McGregor at a bar. And then they did go to Cannes, like it showed there through one of his partners. But the timing
of it. Well,
it's
important to note another production company did decide to finance it. Miramax pulled out. Mm-hmm. And another production company did decide to finance it for less than half the budget. So it was $6 million instead. And he was desperate at this point. So he did take it. And then it did show at Cannes. And it got very limited distribution after the fact with a small distributor, Franchise Features. So yeah, that's how we got there. It did show at Cannes and eventually
it
got
showed
bought,
at
but
Cannes.
Not
but the problem that it had, in addition to being a first time director and writer, and obviously not perfect subject matter, I don't think this would have won the Palme d'Or at Cannes anyway, but it should have gotten at least financed. The reason it didn't was because this was shortly after Columbine. And nobody wanted to pick up a movie, a major distributor for something that had to do with guns and killing and whatnot when there was these terrible, you know, school shootings. But yeah, so it got released. Do you know off the top of your head? I know it didn't make shit at the box office, right?
Yeah. So budget was $6 million, like we said. And then what it made in theaters was $30,471. And
that's
the reason
30,000.
Was
yeah.
30,000. And that is because it only ran for 7 days and it ran across five theaters. So they had very limited distribution, and he didn't have a great deal with them. He was just desperate for any deal. So it becomes a whole thing. It leads to a lawsuit later. Like he doesn't make any of the royalties back. This is a film that, as you, most of you listening to this heard of this from someone else, and it was a word of mouth, not even a cult classic, because it was pretty quick that people loved this film, similar to like, reminds me of The Crow in the way that The Crow built as well. And it's a similar energy, and it was around the same time. And so it leads to 50 million in domestic video sales. Mm-hmm. And he at the time gets none of that. And so it leads to this big lawsuit, and he does end up winning the rights and some undisclosed amount of the royalties.
Yeah. I mean, the dude just seemed like a mess. And again, I will say he's 26. I kind of get how stupid you are at that age. And if you had all these opportunities, you might be a little careless, just given his upbringing and whatnot as well. But I did love the tagline of that documentary overnight. If you do decide to watch it, the tagline is "There's more than one way to shoot yourself." And it kind of works on multiple levels, because he's, you know, shooting this movie that he is actually makes it a small appearance mm-hmm. in. But then it's just him shooting himself career-wise of doing all this stuff. Apparently, the folks who filmed the documentary, he was all about it. He had made Boondock Saints, experienced all this shit stuff, but wanted them. He was like enraptured to be the focal point of this documentary, and thought he looked good throughout it. And you watch it and you're just like, buddy, you are missing the mark with your outlook on life. So
my favorite thing, in just slight sidebar, is in documentaries where people think they're helping themselves and they're really making themselves look so bad. It's actually wildly common. The first one that comes to mind to me actually is that Curious Case of Natalia Grace that's on HBO. Her like stepdad in that looks like the biggest, utmost piece of shit you've ever met in your life. And he just thinks that he's like the star of the show, you know? So it sounds like this, that he's similar. Sounds like he thinks that as well. Ugh, gross. Well, listen, one thing I will say, because we just shat on him for 5 minutes. Yeah, he sounds like a fucking douchebag. But he wrote this script while bartending in LA on a rented computer, and ends up getting paid $500K for the script itself out of the gate. And it sucks, yeah, because he whether intentionally or unintentionally, does so much with this film and the meta references and the fun of it all and the energy of it. Like, you could see him becoming not quite a Guy Ritchie energy, but like a similar type of like these kinds of capers, these kinds of action films in Bruise, you know, like I could see him making those types of films. And yeah, he really shot himself in the foot. So he has a very natural talent here. And I don't know if maybe he's just a victim of his own massholeness. I'm not sure. I love a masshole. Massholes and I get along great, but apparently he did it wrong.
110%, dude. Like, he could have been something. He does get compared. This movie gets compared to sort of Guy Ritchie stuff. And I guess Troy Duffy actually gets pissed every time that's brought up, because this came out before Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. So he doesn't like that comparison. He's okay with being compared to Tarantino. He said Pulp Fiction did inspire him. But I just feel like for a first time script, it's really fucking tight. As silly as some of the movie is,
it's very tight.
It's a great
script. The references are incredible. There's actually a lot of, I have several notes throughout of just like the subtle references. And if you watch it once, you can't possibly catch them all, but you watch them over and over and you pick out something new every time. Like, he is an, I think, unintentionally really great writer, because again, he was an aspiring musician at this time and his band was called The Brood. They renamed after the film came out, because they did some of these songs for the film. They went to name themselves the Boondock Saints. But I think he stumbled upon this talent, and I'm sure he worked on it. I'm sure he edited it. I'm not saying this was a fucking first draft, but I think he stumbled upon this talent, and yeah, absolutely could have done a lot with it. I think we could have seen a lot of really cool work out of him, which super sucks.
Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, I don't know if you saw the sequel, but it wasn't great. It was fine.
I didn't. Again, I said this about The French Connection. I can be kind of a purist, and I'm like, I don't want something to ruin my like awesome first experience, especially when it feels like it can't possibly be better. The Matrix that you called out, for example, that's one I wish I had never watched the second one. Maybe none of the following, you know, because the first one is just so fucking good and you just can't, you know.
Yeah, it's a good self-contained story. You don't need more than that. And I felt the same. We waited, I think, 10 years for the Boondock Saints sequel. And by the time it came out,
yeah, literally 10 years.
Kind of like numb to. I wasn't really super excited about it. I watched it just to watch it. And I was like, this was fine, but I didn't need this. And so some people, it turns out, have one awesome idea. And you could say that about people in Hollywood. You could say it about musicians. It's like they put out one great piece of art, but it's been building throughout their lifetime to build this, release this one great thing. And it turns out that was kind of all they had. And that's okay. But I'm wondering if that's what it is with how little he's done since.
I mean, that's the story of many a one-hit wonder, right? Of like, they got one in them, and it doesn't detract from that great piece of art that they made,
right?
But it's a one-time thing. I also think it's notable that it was a 10-year gap here. He had been through a lot of shit. He had to get, you know, go through this lawsuit to get this stuff. Who knows, again, what he could have done if he had been actively working during this time, and he could have maybe done it better. You just will never know. But I think, to your point, this is a great self-contained story and piece of art in its own right, and it's really good. So all right, homie, let's get into some cast and then go on to the fun stuff. This is a pretty big cast, but we spend the majority of our time with a handful of people, so that's who I'm going to focus on. Willem Dafoe, we've talked about him before, we will talk about him again. Fucking legend. Plays FBI agent Paul Smecker, which is just such like a funny last name. Recent stuff for him, in case, since we haven't talked about him for a minute, Nosferatu just came out this last year that he was in. He did a really incredible job.
He was good in that. He was not a vampire in that, but I randomly stumbled across a fun fact that Willem Dafoe is the only actor to ever be nominated for playing a vampire role. And I thought that maybe somebody in Interview with a Vampire would have gotten it. Nope. None of the vampires in Nosferatu got it. Only person ever to be nominated for an acting role as a vampire.
That's funny, because I thought either Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise, were nominated for Interview, but I guess not. Interesting. I think that Kirsten Dunst was, though, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, that's fascinating. Also, he did The Florida Project. I bring that up because we talked recently about Anora, which was done by Sean Baker, same guy. And then Poor Things, which we have done here on the pod. And as so you know, we think is so fucking good. Exactly. So, yeah, legend leads us with the just fucking incredible turn in this role, which we'll get into. Sean Patrick Flannery, which, fun fact, if you check out pictures of him recently, looks wildly different.
In the sequel, I remember that I went, his face looks different.
Different.
I didn't want to make judgments, but it looked like Sean Patrick Flannery had spent that decade doing a little bit of binge drinking. That's all I'm going to say.
What he was doing, but it was not healthy, perhaps. Yeah. Connor McManus is who he plays, but he plays he has the I wanted to call this out, he has the Veritas tattoo, so he's my guy in theory for this one. He's from Houston, if you didn't know, which is a fun fact for us Texans.
Actually in real life have an Irish accent? Because I mean, his last name's Flannery, so I didn't want to assume, but is he actually Irish?
I don't think he I think he might be Irish, but I don't think he has an Irish accent.
He has a good accent.
He does a good job. And I wanted to call out the one of his roles that I remember and loved, but it's I don't know if it's feels like it's kind of niche. Powder. Did you ever see Powder?
That was in like the 90s, right? I did not see it.
Well, he plays Powder, and it's a really interesting, I don't know, almost, well, not paranormal. I don't know. It's an interesting story about a young man who has albinism, but like to an extreme degree, full body, and he's contained inside for most of his life, and he wants to get out for a number of reasons. It's not how albinism works, just to be super clear, but it was a really interesting film, and he did a good job, as I remember it. I haven't seen it in many, many, many years, but it's an interesting one.
Did you ever see the movie Suicide Kings? That's the only other thing I think I've seen Sean Patrick Flannery in, and it's another one. In this one, you get Dafoe. In that one, you get Christopher Walken, and it's another one where it was like popular in college, but I'm scared to watch it after 22 years. But it's basically this group of friends. There's a pretty good cast, and I think Johnny Galecki from Big Bang Theory and a few other things is in it. But they basically, Christopher Walken, I think he's like a rich businessman, or maybe he's like a drug lord. He's got money, and they kidnap him and hold him for ransom, this random group of friends. And it's just them in a room with Christopher Walken and him being like, you're all going to fucking die because you kidnapped, you know, me and blah, blah, blah. It's actually
pretty
entertaining.
But did you like it?
Okay. I liked it when I was in college. I'm curious to give it a rewatch, but like I said, a little bit hesitant. A
little bit worried. Maybe yeah. I'll watch it because I've never seen it and I'll let you know.
Let me know.
Because I'm curious. Yeah. So he does do a great Irish accent, though. I will agree with you. I haven't seen him in a lot of other stuff, but he does a good job here. Norman Reedus does not have a great Irish accent, but he also does a good job here on the whole. But his accent is not the reason. He
plays the brother Murphy. I have to do that. Like, I wanted to. My other idea for the cold open was to have you deliver your worst acted line in this film, and for me, it's him going like, "What kind of flowers you want at your funeral? Because it's the last time I'm going to see you." It's very bad. It's very bad.
That is not the one that like stood out to me, but yeah. It is a good one. It's really his final speech to me that like their big moment, which we'll get to. Like the accent in that is so bad. And it hasn't been great the whole time, but he's like yelling and you can tell he super loses it. But anyway, he does a good job. He's kind of the little brother though, so it's not that big a deal. Whatever. Murphy McManus.
And if you had asked me like after the even when watching this when I was, you know, 18 years old. I assumed Sean Patrick Flannery was going to be a huge star. And I wrote off
for
Norman
sure.
Reedus because I think after that, all I saw him in was Blade 2 and mm-hmm. then fucking Walking Dead hit. And he is a superstar now.
I was about to say, you probably all know him from Walking Dead. That's the thing that he's most well known for. And maybe, I don't know, embarrassing fact, I have never seen The Walking Dead. It was one of those that like, one, I'm not a big zombie person. I've said this on the pod before. It's not my shtick. But it was one of those things where I kind of like dug my heels in every now and then. I do this with a TV show. If like everyone's watching it, I'm like, fuck you. I'm not going to watch it. So I had like a weird, like rebellious moment with The Walking Dead. And then it got too big and too long. And now it's a whole fucking project to try and watch The Walking Dead. So I have never seen not a one episode of that show.
It's very
but I hear
fine,
it's great.
But if you did not like zombies, you will not like it. I think that's the main reason, obviously, to watch. But it's fine.
Yeah, I'm not a huge zombie person, but whatever. It feels like I missed a cultural moment, though. You know what I mean? Like when that happens. Anyway,
it's got whatever. Moments of brilliance. There's episodes that are great, and there are moments that are super emotional. But for a lot of it is a slog, and it just overstayed its welcome. And now there's like 18 spinoffs.
That's what I mean. There's like so much to get in. Whatever. Anyway, okay. I'm not probably not going to watch it. Just kidding. He has the Equitas tattoo, by the way. That's your mm-hmm. boy. Mm-hmm. David Della Rocco plays Rocco. So I think that's.
And even when it gives you like the text of his full name, it's just his name. I guess him and Duffy are friends, right? Him and Troy Duffy.
Yeah, yeah. So, and he doesn't do a lot else either. Like, so it kind of holds up. He does both Boondock Saints, and then he does one other film that I haven't seen, Dead in Five Heartbeats. So yeah, he does a good job here, but I can see him like not being able to do much else either, though. So I'm surprised he wasn't maybe. You know, another goon and some other things. Like he could do this kind of thing again.
He's very charming in this and very funny. Yeah. His delivery is spot on.
He's
but
the funny guy. Funny man. Sorry.
I'm having a shitty day. Tell me a funny joke.
Tell me a funny joke.
Continue I'm going to do every accent poorly today in Norman Reedus's honor, but I was going to say, I think he's been friends with Troy Duffy since they were kids or teenagers. And so Troy knew that his friend was into acting a little bit and I guess gave him this role. I think he nails it in this, but it's weird that, he doesn't do anything else really.
It doesn't really translate, I guess. But I agree with you. Like some of these don't play out the way you think. I mean, Willem Dafoe is undeniable and of course goes on to be fucking brilliant. But I agree with you. I would have read Sean Patrick Flannery as the guy who gets famous and he does fucking nothing after this. So I would love to know why. I mean, not nothing, but not a lot.
Notable, I guess.
Nothing notable. And he's big into jujitsu, if you didn't know. And he owns a jujitsu, you know, whatever. What do they even call that?
Gyms?
Gym? Gym. I guess a gym. Jujitsu gym, whatever. Anyways, so like
similar
that's
to Pokemon. They work out of gyms. So.
Exactly. Maybe that's why his face got different now that I think about it. Like maybe he's like
catching elbows,
working out and getting like punched in the face. And like he's been through some shit. I don't know. Anyways. All right. Closing us out is Billy Connolly, who is Il Duce. And he's been in a few things. He kind of has a bit more range than some of these other folks. He did Brave, which I think is such a fun juxtaposition.
A lot
against
of voice
this
acting
one.
I saw on his.
Yeah. he has a great voice for it. So like, mm-hmm. it totally checks out. He also did Mrs. Brown, which has like a Judi Dench is in that. It's also very well known for that film, but I've actually never seen it. And then does the X-Files movie, which I love that this is the second time in 2 weeks that we've had an X-Files reference. We go, what, a year with no X-Files references, but now we got two in 2 weeks. I never saw the movie, but I was an X-Files fan, so good on you.
I think I did, and I feel like it was mostly forgettable. But yeah, I remember a weird one that I picked out of my memory was he's in Pocahontas. I remember hearing his voice distinctly in Pocahontas. And then we covered him in Muppet Treasure Island, too. He was one of the human characters in that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a good one. He plays such a small but impactful character here, so it's good that he's here.
And then last thing, I know he's not I guess he's major cast in this, but I wanted to call out Detective Greenlee, who I think is one of the funnier parts of this.
Fair.
Actor name, Bob Marley.
Bob Marley.
And he's a comedian, actually. Yes. Yeah. But I guess in 1999, you didn't really worry too much about Google SEO. It's just like, maybe we should have changed Bobby Marley, something a little different, so you're not competing against one of the greatest artists of all time.
Yeah, now if you Google him, you have to add comedian or you're not going to find him for sure. Yeah. All right, homies, quick plot summary. Two Irish Catholic brothers become vigilantes in order to try to wipe out Boston's criminal underworld, quote, in the name of God. Pretty accurate. Fair enough.
100%. You know?
Got right down to it. So I think let's like dig right in. I fucking love this movie.
Like, I love the intro, like the priest speaking and like the I do
that
believe the
homily
got for the point.
It's such a strong homily, and I just love that it's kind of a sparsely attended church. I think it's supposed to be right. You're supposed to feel like this community is pretty rotten. You know, you're supposed to feel that this is like a dark underbelly area. There's not a lot of good people in the area and it's overrun in a lot of ways. And it informs this homily about this girl who's murdered Kitty and nobody does anything about it.
That's a true story, right? Like that actually happened, what he's talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, this is South Boston. Like this is it can be kind of an intense area, can be, especially at this time, I should say. And so it's known as being quote unquote dangerous. It is also known as being very Irish Catholic. And so, you know, this is where you're going to get your conscience, so to speak, is coming through these homilies via the priests. And this is a Monsignor, which means he's kind of like a little bit of an elevated priest, if you didn't know that. And so they walk up onto the altar and just go kiss the feet of the crucifix, which is bold to say the least. Yeah. And he doesn't blink an eye, you know, it just sets such a tone. And then, to your point, they walk outside and it's just, I guess the Monsignor's finally getting the point.
It just feels like a superhero. It's like, these guys are special. They're like our heroes in our neighborhood. They could do whatever the fuck they want at church. And speaking of that, they could not film any of this in actual Catholic churches. The Catholic churches in that area would not let them just based on the subject matter of the film. So they did it in Lutheran churches because Lutherans do not give a fuck.
Lutherans are chill as fuck, though, truly. Like, if you ever go to a Lutheran church, they're so sweet. They're so welcoming. They do not care at all. It checks out. It checks out that they would do it in a Lutheran church. They pick a church that does look quite a bit like a Catholic church,
for sure.
To be fair. Yeah, it's a very good choice. So it fits. It still fits. But and even like the vestments, like somebody Catholic, I mean, I guess Troy Duffy, probably being from South Boston, is probably Catholic. Somebody Catholic made this movie because it's pretty accurate, pretty accurate for that. Yeah. But yeah, like you said, it just gives like superhero vibes right out the gate. You love these brothers. I love the music. It's got that like Irish dandy, like bouncy music to it.
I cannot remember the pronunciation, but I used to have that on like a burned CD in college. That's dating me, but I think it's the Ballad of Choo Choo Lane or something like that is what the track is called. And it just, when that starts playing at the beginning, I get like a little bit of a chill. Just, I'm so excited that this movie is starting and they have that whole sequence where they're working at like the meatpacking plant or whatever. How did you feel? That's another thing we didn't talk about in the intro, but the whole striking a woman thing there, how does that play for you in 2025?
Okay, well, that's a trap. So, okay, this Irish jig is setting this tone. It's showing them, you know, fucking around in this meatpacking plant, and they're clearly beloved. Like, everyone loves them. They're part of the family and they're just having fun and like they're shooting the shit. I think that is a common theme, like all the way up until they kind of take on this mantle that they do later of they're like, they're just beloved in their community and they're genuinely good guys. And they're just trying to have like a good time and live overall pretty simple life. And I don't think they do anything to her to get this chip on her fucking shoulder. That's the thing that I will say is like, she's at a fucking thousand out of nowhere. And they even try to bring her down. They're like, we're just trying, like, we're just fucking around. We're having a good time. And then she just wants to, she wants to pick a fight. And she is a big, strong woman, and you can tell she can physically pick a fight if she wants, and she does. And yeah, I would not necessarily excuse hitting anybody. Let me be clear, not just a woman, but like hitting anybody. I wouldn't necessarily excuse it. But I do think it's like almost a natural reaction. Somebody just hit the shit out of you, and you just like, I don't know. I feel like you just react, you know? Yes.
And especially if it's somebody you care about, like your brother. I will say, I'm going to say this a couple times today is, there's a deleted or extended scene in this where they did film the entirety of them giving her the tour and like the uncomfortable, like the little conflicts that she's bringing up, and they're just disagreeing on little things. So you get that she's already a little annoyed. There's a one significant thing that is cut where during the midst of this argument, the rule of thumb, all that stuff, she has already struck him once. I think she slaps him. And they kind of let it slide. And that's why there's a shot where it shows Norman Reedus like reacting. And you're like, why is he already angry? He kind of like rubs his mouth because his brother just got slapped. But you don't see that. So then when she kicks him in the nuts, that's when he's like, okay, now you're getting punched in the face. Again, not defending it, but it makes a little more sense now.
It's more of a build as to like, hey, we already let it slide once. And like now somebody just needs to smack you back. Yeah. I mean, listen, sometimes people, sometimes they've earned it. You know what I mean? But yeah, it is a, it's hard to let slide, but it, again, it kind of sets the tone for this whole energy. And then you see them go into the bar and they're just like in their neighborhood bar with their friends. And, you know, you can tell it's just a vibrant community and they're the regulars and they have a relationship with the bartender and Rocco, who's Italian, which again, at this point and at this time, like it's very easy to have this rivalry between Italian guys and Irish guys in South Boston. And they love him anyway. Like they all just love each other anyway. So I think it's a very intentional setting of the stage here.
Yeah.
And I love the whole vibe of just like the Irish pub and the hanging out of it all and the music and the community and all that. St.
Paddy's Day. Everybody's Irish today and they're just good
Everybody's
vibes.
Irish and having like, a good time.
And little shout out here, the Boondock Saints are also in the bar. So the band that you mentioned at the beginning, including Troy Duffy and his brother, are some of the extras in that bar scene. I will say when the Italian or the Russian mobsters come in, that's one of the weaker performances in the film. It does feel a little like goofy at that point. But again, watch it as a superhero film. You probably have a great time. And we get that sort of conflict right off the bat. And then we sort of time jump. But did you have anything else to add on like that barroom scene and where we go from there?
I love the Star Trek reference. But like
this here's McCoy.
The Chekhov moment is like, I was like, these are the kind of nuggets that I'm talking about in this movie that I'm like, there's this little gem for me. My little nerdy self is like, this is so good. And
us a Spock. We got us an away team. That's a great
It's such a good line. And I love like Chekhov is so charming and great in Star Trek. And like this guy could not be further from that. So it's also just fun in that way as well. But yeah, it's definitely it's a comical bar conflict and they are like the most absurd versions of Russians that they could be. And it just checks out and it's kind of fun. And you cut to, they've had this, I just love that structure that continues throughout of you see the results of the conflict and then you see the cops trying to figure it out. And you don't immediately see Willem Dafoe in the first one, but it continues to be that Willem Dafoe is translating these scenes throughout the film of like, this is what happened. And he's reading the scenes so well, and it gets more and more escalated as he does it.
Like I said, tight fucking script in how he, I don't know if he wrote that into the script or like how much of it was at like post where he was like, oh, this would maybe, I feel like it was probably in the script, but how he gets more and more intertwined with what they're doing, where it's no longer a cutaway to show. And by the end, he's sort of like observing the thing as it happens. So it's just him and being a great detective and reading the room and reading the situation each time throughout.
Yeah, and I just love that it's becomes this like FBI super smart detective versus the entire Boston police force, who are apparently in his eyes made up of idiots, and emblematic of by Greenlee, who genuinely is a bonehead throughout. But the other guys are like, they take it as an opportunity to kind of learn over the course of the film. You see them like really respect him and want to learn from him. And in this first scene, he just fucking reads the room. And I love that you get this flashback when they, you know, they go back to the station. He's read the scene. They're there. Greenlee makes his very poor prediction of they're going to avoid the police at all costs. And they come walking up the stairs. And I just love that side by side of him like being such a fucking numbnuts. And then they're like limping up the stairs. And it's just, it's such a great send off. And then he, you know, and then he's like, okay, Greenlee. Onion bagel, cream cheese.
You mentioned the relationship and the dynamic between him and the cops, and we spoke about this a little bit in the cold open, but apparently this was a conscious move by Troy Duffy to have the character of Smecker be homosexual. He thought this was really important to the story, and it does show, like you said, the relationships over time of him. There's a couple awkward moments in the, like, the more you watch this, the more you
notice.
There
are several.
When he, I forget what exactly, oh, he puts his hand on the shoulder of one of the cops. And he's
he
like, you know,
touches
try and
a lot
me.
Of them. He's very touchy.
And they give looks of like, wink,
why
wink.
You touch me, bro?
Look at the, well, not even that, but when they're observing him, I forget what the other Alapopscallies, the one with the weird, I might've gotten that right, but he kind of nudges the other detective of like, look, he's a homosexual. Mm-hmm. And it feels like it's going to be a thing. But then over the course, they become friendly and friends. And it's like, this doesn't even matter anymore. It's just these guys who are doing the same job, and they've kind of mutually started respecting each other over the course of this.
Well, again, I think they see that he knows his shit, you know, and they want to learn from him because they wouldn't have necessarily thought that he was right in some of these scenes. You know, they, you can tell they've leaned to Greenlee for whatever reason, probably because he's the most boisterous, loud force in any room.
If you talk very loud and confidently, people might start to think you know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And I think that like they realize, oh, actually Greenlee's kind of a dumbass and this guy's pretty smart. And so that I think sometimes when you get to know people or you really respect them anyway, you sort of ignore some of that other stuff, but it does pepper in. I will say, like, they say stuff later that becomes relevant. Like, they don't dismiss it entirely is what I will say. They are very aware of it and it is different for them, but yes, there is this like respect regardless. And almost more so than he shows himself in some cases, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, the last thing I wanted to add was, Duffy, as I said, made this an intentional choice. I think he had a homosexual friend that he knew was closeted and hadn't come out to his friends and family yet. And apparently this movie, and so now take, again, we know what we've said about Troy Duffy, take it with a grain of salt. But he said that after this movie came out, that friend felt comfortable enough in the city of Boston to come out to his friends and family. So,
well, imagine, because you get this character who is, again, undeniably capable, smart, and in many ways masculine, but is gay, and they depict it in such a way that it doesn't negate anything else that he does, right? Like, he's a whole ass person, because by the way, gay people are, I don't know, breaking news. And so, right. And so, like, he's not one dimensional. He's this whole ass person that they get to, he gets to have depth and clarity, and, but he is not uncomplicated, right? Like, he is almost as homophobic toward himself as the community would be at this time. And I think that's intentional. I think there's a little bit of self-loathing that happens there of like, these are my preferences and I can't fucking control it, but I don't like it necessarily. And I think that's supposed to make him a complicated figure. And maybe that's informed by his friend who was probably maybe struggling on his own with this, like, should I be totally comfortable in my sexuality or not? And he's very denigrating to his own community throughout. You see it. And that's the part that is really hard to watch, because you know, you don't want to see the gay community be treated this way. But I think it says a lot more about him and it's supposed to than it does anybody else.
He feels like the most, when I think about it, I think he's the most complex character in the entire film. I don't think that's a controversial opinion. When you, I mean, the brothers are pretty straightforward. They're killing people. They feel like they got to do that. Rocco's funny, but he's on board with these guys. The villains are kind of paint by numbers, but Smecker is complex. And at the beginning, when he's doing the opera music, anyway, we feel like he has everything together, and he just gets more and more disheveled throughout this, especially
that's what I was saying, like it gets scenes, more
sweating
intense.
His tie, his shirt is ripped, and he is feels the most unhinged at times throughout this film. He's going to the bar and like binge drinking until dawn and then stumble it, like he's taking all of this very personally, and it just again makes him feel like the most interesting character in this group of very crazy characters.
We could talk about his character for an hour easily.
Oh, he's nailing the assignment. Defoe fucking crushes it.
Yeah, he just is the most interesting character, and he's the one you want to understand the most and dig into the most. What I really want to dig into is his fucking coffee order, though. What in the actual fuck is that order? Like, I need to know, Troy Duffy, was that your friend's coffee order?
Lemon.
Because how the hell else did you pick that? Cafe latte with a twist of lemon and sweet and low. And I was like, nope, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
You know, I thought I liked Smecker, and then you reminded me of the sweet and low, and I just cannot do fake sugar. I'm sorry, guys. Give me the drugs. Right. Give me all the endorphins in my head.
I can't respect it. If you're going to do it, just fucking do it. You know what I mean? Like, but yes, anyway, he's great, other than his coffee
order. Can I do, not a super hard pivot, but something that I wanted to ask you about was, do you feel... And I'd be curious to also hear from any of our listeners that are comfortable with it, if you're in the LGBTQ plus community. I feel like this movie has a decent amount, not a ton, but some homoerotic tension, some moments where I was like, huh, I wonder if this is how this is meant to be interpreted or if this is just something underlying on the surface. But I wrote down there's the water scene when the two brothers are in the prison and they're shirtless, but in jeans, the water pours down on their chests and they sit up in bed all like very sexy and like breathing heavily. I was like, that looks, it's a little different than how I remember it being in college. There's also the thing, like, and granted, this could be something, you know, I've kissed my male friends on the cheeks before. It's not uncommon, but I always thought it was weird when Sean Patrick Flannery puts his hand
kisses
over his mouth
Rocco,
and kisses
but he
Rocco.
Does it with the filter.
It's the everything with Smecker. I think maybe that's not homoeroticism, but it's like, does any of that land for you? Like, is that making sense? Or is that not something that you pick up on really as much as I am?
I mean, I certainly notice it for sure, but I don't know that it like takes away from the story at all.
Oh,
or
no,
distracts
not, that's
me.
Not
well,
what
not
I
takes
mean
away,
but... anyway. I just didn't know if there were folks out there who this might have been like an awakening, or maybe they had a different relationship with this movie than I did because of any of that stuff that is in there. But
Listen, I think any hot characters anywhere can result in a sexual awakening, and Sean Patrick Flannery, especially in this film, could have opened up a gay awakening for a lot of people because he looks fabulous.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think it like it doesn't stand out to me as being really overt per se. No, it didn't like distract me or anything.
Oh, the other one that I forgot was the when they're sealing their wounds shut with the hot iron.
Oh my
there's
God,
a lot of
yeah.
like grasping of hair and things like that. Again, maybe I just got sex on the brain. I don't know, but that's I'm reading these. And
maybe
I'm just like,
you're just horny. I just like that's a you problem. You know,
honestly,
what I mean?
No, yeah, that's. I don't think it's a problem. I just think that's me.
It's not a problem, but it's just the situation. Yeah. No, but I see what you're saying. I feel like you know that maybe is one of the ways in which he was influenced by Tarantino. Like that scene in particular, like the iron scene, does kind of give me that like Tarantino energy as well, which I do feel like always has like a subtle little sexual subtext to a lot of that sometimes. Yeah. So I could see that. Yeah.
I agree. What are your thoughts on, I don't want to skip around too much because I felt like we were going narrative structure wise, but
like that Discman that probably didn't have skip protection while he's going around the whole. See, I'm sorry. I have been waiting to talk about that. And you just like cued me. I was like, does it have shock protection? I said it out loud to Skylar while we were watching this. I was like, but does it have shock protection? He's walking all over this crime scene. I bet it's skipping the song. Anyway,
I remember it being a big deal when they added the technology to Discmans where you could have them sideways and they wouldn't skip. Cause it used to be, you had to have it upright. Otherwise you were fucked.
You had to hold it.
So, yep.
Yeah. I had the cheap ones for the longest time. We were real broke, but I would steal my mom sometimes that had the skip protection and I would always get in so much trouble. Anyway.
Well, so that's sort of the aftermath of what we end up seeing with this action sequence with like the toilet being thrown off the rail. We don't have to dig into everyone, but like, what are your overall takeaways on sort of the different action sequences in this, whether it is that toilet scene, him jumping off the roof onto the guys down below. There's that one. There's the billiard scene where it's sort of like a shootout. There's the rope swinging in the hotel. Like, where do you want to go as far as action's concerned?
I just love all of it. It's so yeah. fucking fun. All of yeah. it is so great. I mean, like, I don't even know where to start. It's so good. The stuntman in the jump off the roof, I have in my notes, Sean Patrick Flannery's stuntman. Oh my God. I tried to find this. I did a deep dive on who is this man so that we could shout him out. But there's just a list of stunt performers. You can't find out who his person is. I listened to interviews. I was trying to give the man credits where it's due. But anyway, he's incredible. And he does this jump. This is like, again, Troy Duffy, like, how is this your first time? And why did you fuck everything up? It's so well shot and it's so well written. And it's the stunt is really well done and it's very believable and it feels really raw and it feels really realistic. And I love that those action sequences are juxtaposed, like I said, against the analysis of the scenes, you know, right. And I love the way we structure that. It's really strong narrative structure. And then Willem Dafoe's commentary is always so not only on the money and really well done, and his commitment to the performance and the bit and analyzing the scenes is so unique and special. It's also peppered with his just fucking snark that is so fun. I love that first scene. They're like talking about 50 caliber bullets going into the wall. And he's like, how did you figure that out? And he's just like, bullet holes are usually a big clue, you know? And I just like, he just has these fucking great one-liners yeah. where he's just roasting these guys. Yeah. And then the rope. Oh my God. I have in my notes too. The whole rope conversation alone, again, juxtaposed against the scene. The rope conversation is hysterical.
There's your reference, the Charlie Bronson. Yep.
The Charlie Bronson reference of it all. And like how meta it is too. It's like, this isn't a movie. We're not in a movie. And it's like,
watching a movie. Yeah.
Right. You become so aware of it and it's subtle enough, but it makes you kind of like, remove yourself from it for a second, and they have this whole conversation. Well, Charlie Bronson always had a rope, and like it speaks to also how amateur they are to this new mission that they have, and they're so charming while they do it though. And then they
start arguing in the
fighting in the duct,
and he's like, I'm sweating my ass off dragging around your
fucking rope. He's just roasting him about the rope the whole time mercilessly, yeah. and then it fucking saves their ass, and it's just so well done. And I love, again, juxtaposed against the scene of him analyzing it. He's like, this is the shit you see in bad television. Like, nobody actually does this. And I just love that observation because it's so true. These guys are such amateurs.
I might be overthinking this a little too much, but I think the rope scenario specifically does lend credence to the fact that maybe in the context of this movie, maybe God is actually, maybe they are on a mission from God because they have these little circumstances and
that are kind of magical,
and that you're fighting and you fall, but it catches you and you get your guns out. You yeah. kill 9 people.
And maybe I love that it's number one, it is such an accident and a miracle and a blessing and whatever yeah. you want to call it. And I love though that they attribute it to how good they are. They immediately were like, we're actually really good at this.
Yeah.
They're so self-congratulatory and like, yeah. you know, this is actually not as hard as you think it is. And it's like, bitch, you fell out of a ceiling and you got really lucky. But it's, again, they're so charming about it that you're like, oh my God, these guys.
And then you get that brilliant Rocco as Jafar coming in.
Oh my God.
Then we have to fuck with him. That whole thing is brilliant. When they're like threatening him, they realize that he has the 6-shooter. There's 9 bodies. What were you going to do? Laugh the last 3 to death? What a script, man. The script is so fucking good.
It's such a good script. And it is also, again, it's peppered with that like bro energy of,
for sure.
It's only this other fucking bro that would mess with this guy who's coming to do his first hit. And they're like, he could be genuinely terrified if they're really fucked. He could have pissed his pants while they come in and put a gun to his head. And they're like, fuck it, let's do it. You know? And again, it's like these silly, like immature guys who have never done this. And it's like buddies fucking with each other. And somehow, again, the way that it's written and the way it's performed makes it feel so charming and hilarious. Yeah. And you're not at all annoyed by it. And you easily could be. So that's like a fine line to walk, I think.
There's the one line of dialogue where I'm I just don't, it might be a product of me having seen this movie probably 10 times in my life, but I still laugh at it, but I do, I'm like, it might be a little much, but the Rocco's delivery of all the different versions of fuck doesn't quite hit the same, but it's great, but it doesn't quite hit the same for me at 40 as it did at 20. But I think fuck gets said a grand total of 246 times in this film. And I think 232 of them are in Rocco's speech.
Or
in
Rocco. Yeah.
But yeah. So what did you, I don't know, any other reactions to any of the action sequences in this? Or
I mean, yeah, again, I love them all, but I do think it's funny that how many times Rocco says that. And then what does he say? It certainly demonstrates the
diversity of the word.
Diversity of the word. And it's just like simple little lines like that, that I think are so funny. I love a few different things. I love how Willem Dafoe mocks them throughout. I love the juxtaposition of the fight scenes. I love how he mocks Greenlee with the, like, he's a huge fucking guy. Like, he just leans into all the accents and the culture and the you know, and they do it too. I love how when they come in, you know, they have that awesome interrogation scene, which isn't really an action scene, but I love the interrogation scene because, again, they don't expect them to be there and they just walk right in and turn themselves in, and so they're already kind of gaining a modicum of respect right there. But then they speak Irish and they speak Russian and they speak French, Italian, German, Spanish, and immediately you see this dynamic of this really established, almost maybe embittered FBI guy all of a sudden fangirl over these two guys.
Yeah, I love how his face, like, lights up in that
his
scene.
His face lights up.
Oh, that's beautiful. He's so impressed.
His smile. Yeah. Yes. Like, his smile is, it's a megawatt smile. He's like just grinning and he's like, what are you guys doing working in a meatpacking plant? He's so blown away by them, which, why would you not be? I get it. They're fucking impressive at this point. But everybody there is so charmed by them.
Yeah.
And I love when he's like, well, we'll have to ask your mother, but it's okay with me if your friends sleep over. It's one of the best fucking lines.
He's such like a, just the charisma that Dafoe oozes in this. And he's such a catty bitch at times, but then he's just like, we keep using the word charming. I think that's such a great term for this film overall. Yeah.
He's so interesting in the way he delivers every line because it, again, I think it speaks to all the facets of his character. He's charming. He's silly. He reads gay. He reads masculine. He's mocking people. He's flirty with people. He's drunk. He's like, he just plays fucking everything in this movie. And it's so engaging to watch.
Yeah, 110% agree. On the flip side of that, you know what we haven't mentioned yet that might be the part of this that's aged the worst? Is Mr. Ron Jeremy as the role of Vincenzo. He's in legal trouble. I believe he's in prison. Or did he die? I can't honestly remember. I think he's either rotting in prison or is on his deathbed, essentially, because I think he might have been found not able to stand trial. But obviously a lot of sexual assault, rape, different allegations came out against him in the last decade or so. He was in porn, which I'm not judging that industry at all, but he was from like the 70s.
He's still alive for the record.
Okay. But, yeah. So he's not in prison, unfortunately, or dead, but a bunch of fucked up shit came out about him and seeing him in this. I think in 1999, it was novel that they got a porn star and were like putting him in this acting role. It's like, oh, that's kind of, and he's playing a scumbag for the record. So it kind of made sense. But that rewatching that this year was like, I wish this had been anybody else.
Yeah, he's really gross. I mean, he plays this character perfectly. I guess they cast him perfectly in that sense. He's a real creep and he plays a creep and he gives you gross energy. He also gives you, like, for lack of a better term, like little bitch energy, because he's like just beholden to Yakavetta and is just like whatever Papa Joe says goes. He can't even laugh at the fucking joke unless he gets the green
until
light
Papa
from
Joe does it first. Yeah.
Right, which it is objectively funny. Like, it's a terrible, terrible joke, but it's an objectively funny joke and unfortunately holds true to this day probably. But anyway, it's like this super racist joke and he's Rocco's struggling to deliver it. And one of my favorite lines is Papa Joe being like, continue the joke. Like, it's just, he's like,
tiny ass sandwich with like three pieces of meat on it.
Oh. He is like, he's an annoying character because he reminds me of somebody that I know personally that I don't like, actually. But he does it so well. And I love like just some of the subtleties of it. And he like, he's having a bad day. He's depressed. He says he's depressed. He opens the sandwich and it's got one layer of meat. And he's just like this face that he makes that's so subtle. And like, while he's telling the joke, he does a really good job. And that's
good for him on being so pro mental health in 90. He was ahead of the curve.
He
of
calls
like, I'm
out
depressed
depression.
Right.
Yeah. He's like, you know what I need? I need a pick me up. So I'll give him that. He's ahead of the game, but he's you know, a mobster. So it's not great.
Yeah,
but
I think it makes sense that we're not going to spend a ton of time on Papa Joe. I think he's a suitable villain. I think it makes sense within this. It's kind of like that.
He's a caricature villain.
Yes. Yeah. He's that very first generic Batman villain in every Batman origin story. If it's just a mobster, never gets caught because he has a ton of money, pays off the right people, and he gets his in the end of this. So, but he's fine. He fills his role fine. I wanted to throw another stat your way because I want to segue into something delicate. We have 33 dead bodies in this and one unfortunate dead feline animal. So that cat scene, how does that hit for you in this day and age?
Listen, we can't kill animals in movies. I can't watch it. I can't do it. It's so hard. Like I think mentioned on the pod, I'm deathly allergic to cats. They are still sweet, beautiful animals, and I do not want one of them to die. There is like a whole quote about Troy Duffy being like, this is the one self-indulgent part of the film for me, because he had apparently a bad breakup with a woman with four cats, and this was like his revenge a little bit. So he's like, this is the one thing that maybe doesn't quite fit the rest of the film. And I think that actually shows. Like, it's not particularly cohesive. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And Rocco kind of goes off the deep end about it and is really denigrating to this woman when he talks to her. I hate that scene. I hate the way that he talks to that woman. I hate that he did this thing.
Yeah, we talked about that. I forget who I was following. I think right after we finished watching in a group of us. And I was just like, that scene had like all the ick that I didn't want. Because for the most part, Rocco's not an angel throughout
the
film. He's
mostly
likable,
though. Yeah.
And in this moment, he's letting all that frustration of what a shitty relationship he's in, which is also buddy part on you. But with that speech where he's yelling at them, it has everything you don't want, which is like, body shaming,
slut shaming,
like,
screaming and threatening women, calling them horrible names. It's I mean, it just fucking has the whole bingo card. It's terrible. Yeah.
Now, I will say, for as fucked up as the scene is, it looks awesome. Whatever special effect for as little budget as they had, that explosion and like the spatter is, from a special effects standpoint, really well done. And I also do like that if you look, when they come back, they put a poster up on the wall in place of the blood spatter to like hide part of it. It's not even mentioned really. It's just a visual gag, but that's great too.
How men clean things, am I right? I can't. It's kind of ridiculous. Yeah. No, I do not like that scene, but I do like it. The cleanup especially vaguely fits with Rocco, the character, so it kind of checks out.
I think
it
only works because they play the humor part. I know it's not funny, but that, the poster bit, and then him saying, is it dead? If they didn't have a couple little things that make you feel okay and remind you this is a movie, that I understand somebody who would say, I wish this wasn't in the film at all, but I'm coming from the perspective of, I think it kind of makes sense, and it adds a weird sense of levity only because they play it so well.
Yeah, I think they play it the best you can. I think you could do without it, though. I think you could do without it, but I also just don't want to see animals die, but that's just me. But one thing I wanted to talk about too is, I mean, I know I keep fangirling over him because of course I did, but Willem Dafoe's character, he just plays so many things, but I love that he's also always the smartest person in the room, and it yields just some of these incredible lines where, like, one of the scenes he's, basically explaining to a Greek guy, you said his name earlier, and I think you actually got it accidentally right. Yeah. But he's the stupid idiot who's like, what's the symbology of that? And he's like,
he's trying to sound smarter than he is.
Right. And he's like, I believe you meant symbolism, and now the Greenleys relinquished his crown of top moron. Let me explain. And it's just like, it flows so naturally. And he explains the basically Greek mythology of it all to him, of paying, you know, the boatman at the River Charon to go across and bring souls across, and why this is all happening. And he says his name, like, and he doesn't even get it. He doesn't get that he's telling you your own mythology of your culture. And he's like, you're the first person to get that right. And he's like, I'm an expert in nameology. And like, it just
nameology.
And he just has so many, funny lines like that. But he, I do think one of the things we have to talk about, like you said earlier, is his progression across these crime scenes. Every time he's analyzing a new one, you see him, you know, to your point, like start to sweat more, lean in more. He's starting to kind of fall apart a little bit. And I think like this is the case that's breaking him, not because he doesn't know that it's fundamentally wrong, like that killing people is bad, but because he's like, but is it good bad? Is it the good kind of bad? And it feels like it's breaking his brain, and it culminates in this, you know, scene in the church, like we see, you know.
It's absolutely a product of him having this sort of moral quandary. And I do want to talk about that part at the church where he's working through that shit with the priest. But I think the other part of it that I don't know that I always picked up on, but because what you talked about before of how charming these brothers are and this conversation they have at the police station, he as a detective is sort of dismissed that they're, that's why he's chasing these people. When I used to watch when I was young, I was like, how does he not know it's these two guys that have been killing mobsters? And he says it even at some point of just like, unless I absolutely missed something. And it makes so much sense that he doesn't think these two, that he's like, they acted in self-defense. These things aren't connected.
Wouldn't be them.
But it makes total sense that he feels lost in this, because he's like, who the fuck are they? Who the fuck are they? And they were right there in front of his eyes. So he's breaking in multiple ways.
Yeah. I think he's realizing that he may have had a soft spot that didn't let him see something that he should have seen. And I think he's disappointed in himself as an investigator. And then he's also, again, to your point, facing that moral quandary. And because, you know, you get this kind of throughout the film, and it comes up in the credits even, of like, you guys need to be in every major city, of like, is this something that society needs to stamp out this kind of criminal behavior that is pervasive and impacts innocent people, not just the criminals? And that's something that he's struggling with, because he's like, well, I'm supposed to uphold the law, but like, I don't have a real problem with what these guys are doing, because the victims are horrible people. So what do I do about this? And I think that scene in the church is so, so strong, because you see him really go through all the facets of that moral quandary. And my favorite part is, leave it to a Boston fucking Irish Catholic priest to be like, what the fuck are you doing in the church, man? Like, what are you, you're not even Catholic. Why are you here? I just love that whole dynamic of like, he has a gun to his back. He's supposed to play it cool with this guy, and he literally cannot help himself but say like, what are you doing in a church if you're not religious? I don't understand. Why are you here? Like, he's so annoyed at the situation, and it just, it adds to the whole scene for me. Like, get out of the church. Just get out of the church. Like,
yeah, there's, I guess that kind of segues us into, sort of gets us to the finale. And there's one element I think is strange. Well, first off, we get that awesome, we didn't really touch too much on the billiard action scene where he is just alongside them firing his gun into the air, which I don't think you're supposed to do as an FBI agent, but sure, why not? And delivering that just all-timer line of, there was a firefight.
Those shots, to your point, are so strong. Again, I think it's this progression of him analyzing the scene. He's now inserting himself into the scene.
Yes.
And that's the difference. Like, that hasn't happened yet. He's now putting himself in the position, like, very physically lowering himself. You see him do it very briefly in the porn room, where he just crosses his arms a little bit. But again, this is the progression of him. He's, like, leaning down. He's doing the shots. He's, like, again, he's sweating through it all. And so it does feel like he's doing this with them. And then, just have this crazy line of, there was a fire. It's so great. It's so great.
I also love that Greenlee actually gets something right for a change. One guy, hey, listen, six guns.
A broken clock is right twice a day, guys. And this is Greenlee's moment. And I love that he is very dismissive of it. He's like, Greenlee, why don't you leave the thinking to me? You know? Yeah. And it turns out he's right. And he's on the payphone with him later. And he was like, it was one guy. Six guns. You know, gets really like a little fucking annoyed, you know.
And he was a senior friggin' citizen. But we get into this finale, and I one thing that always didn't land perfectly for me is they just sort of they're talking to the detective. He knows it's them at this point. They tell them they're going up to Papa Joe's house. Detective Smecker finds out, okay, he's got all his guys up there waiting. It's kind of an ambush kind of situation. But we just jump to them already being held captive. And I didn't know if maybe there was a scene that could have bridged that gap a little more clearly.
I think there's a deleted scene. I do think there's – I haven't seen it in ages because I do have this on DVD because, of course, I do. Same. And I do think there's a – I do think there's a deleted scene that but I don't remember the details. I feel like I've seen it before because I agree. I think that's the one area where we get kind of a jump. And I mean, you can connect the dots because you know that he figures out that they're walking into a trap and okay, that happened. But you do sort of want to see how they experienced that.
Yeah, like how did somebody actually get the best of them after all the good luck?
Yeah, because you're like, they're so, you know, they're so good at this. And yes, they're blessed or lucky or whatever you want to call it. How did they actually get the jump on them, you know?
Yeah, so that home invasion scene where we just sort of jump to when they're being held captive, you get the Smecker dressing up as a woman scene. Not what I would call a super attractive female. No disrespect.
This guy is like drooling over her. I pointed out to my kids,
I think Chris and Janelle said that too. And I said, well, they cast the right guy for this role because if they had cast a 10, he would have been like, it's okay, ma'am. You get out of here. We don't need any prostitutes tonight. But because he's like a 4, it makes total sense that he'd go, she's so hot. I have to have her, you know?
You know, I don't know. I think I agree with you, like generally speaking, but I wonder if you're like working all the time in this like bad mafia situation, you got to like take your chances where you get them and you're just like, you know, let's fucking go. I don't know if it's just that he's like ready to go because he needs to get some. But yeah, he's really gross. That whole scene is gross. Leave it to William Dafoe like to just lean in and shove his tongue down his throat.
Everywhere.
Yeah. And it's just funny because you're like, This I know this is not going to end the way we think, but it's painful to watch a little bit. And then his wig slips and it's just a hysterical reason
that
for it to all come up. Slow-mo
where he comes up and shoots and he does the thing with his lips.
That
like kind of raspberry type thing is so, it feels out of place in the movie, but it works, you know?
I think it's also, him like on the other side of this. You know what I mean? I think it's like, we haven't seen him be the trigger man, you know? And like, I don't know. I agree. It somehow works, but it doesn't fit. And I just feel like it's him processing being the trigger man.
He immediately has to do that whole like too far. But then he's like, it's on. Yeah. Now. He admits, okay, I've crossed the line. Like, no going back now.
I'm here, man. I'm here and I got to do it. And I just feel like part of that is him going like, oh, fuck, you know, like, and he's just here. Yeah.
I was going to say, I do love that there are some threads. I want to get into a big one that I don't really enjoy without the deleted scenes to connect it. But I do enjoy that they point out early in the film that Il Duce, no women, no kids. That's his only rule, but he'll kill mobsters like nobody's business. So that is the reason that Willem Dafoe is the exception to all these people getting killed in this house, is he has the wig on. No matter how attractive of a woman he makes, Il Duce does not kill him because of that loophole.
Yeah. I mean, it saves his bacon. Again, like, this is a very fortuitous dynamic across the board. And it does make it feel like, you know, fated, you know, like it was supposed to be this way. And
it's a throwaway line. But again, that's the sign of a tight script, is the rule was established.
We've closed the loop
here. Why is
he
killing everyone else but him? Yep.
We know exactly why. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the one thing that I want to tie into that still kind of doesn't hit fully for me. Il Duce, love Billy Connolly, love the one guy, six guns. I have a couple bones to pick with the movie in this regard. Number one, how the fuck does this guy get parole? He's wheeled in, chained, put in a cage, and there's a committee of four people, and they go, you know what? He's done his time. He seems like he's redeemed.
Well, they also deal with that in the script too. Is there's ways they mention that when they're talking to Papa Joe, where they're like, he's looking at his record and he's going like, oh my God, this guy's like, you know, nuts. And he's like, well, there are ways to deal with that too. And then you get the stamp of parole. Like, the implication is absolutely that he corruptly paid some people off to get this guy parole.
I just feel like no matter how much money you have, it's very difficult to be like, this guy killed 50 people, but let's give him a week out of the prison. Just, it seems very strange. Like, I get that you can bribe, but I feel like getting a murderer out of prison is still I don't know that there's any bribe that's going to do that. But the bigger concern I have is, especially the first time I watched this, the him being their father twist.
I love it so much.
I needed more from that. And I know there were, I remember on the DVD, there were deleted scenes where their mother is actually a character and they have a phone conversation. They talk about their dad has been missing, blah, blah, blah. Or like they never met their father, all this stuff. So that I think would have helped a little more, but I just remember being like, wait, what the fuck? What this guy, oh, they're related. And they talk about the prayer and that's sort of the only breadcrumb you get prior to that point.
We just have to talk about this prayer though. Like this prayer is so beautiful.
It's, I love badass. That
Rocco yeah. tries to get in on the player earlier and they're like, nah, man, that's like a family thing. You don't touch that yeah. shit. And I just, and they're so, you know, inclusive of Rocco, even though he's a fucking just full blown fuck up basically. And it just like the way they deliver it, the cadence of it, it's so beautiful. And just the way that it ends and, you know, the, you know, and we shall flow a river forth to thee and teeming with souls shall it ever be. It's like that. Oh, I'm such an English nerd too, where like I'm like the cadence of this and the delivery of this is so poetic yeah. and beautiful, and ending it with in nomine Patria Filii Spiritus Sancti. Like it's so poetic and beautiful, and it's touched on juxtaposed with actual murder, like just terrible, yeah. horrible action sequences. And it somehow just complements it so well in such a violent oh, motion absolutely. Every violent time that it's
I
used.
Think it makes sense with all the descriptors you're giving of how beautiful and poetic it is that we know that Troy and his brother are songwriters. So it makes sense mm-hmm. that they wrote this original mm-hmm. for the film. And it turned out really not just like the rhyme, but like the lyrics to it yeah. itself are great, but just the messaging in it of everything you just described of this is some heavy shit. And that's what Rocco says. Like that's some cold blooded shit. It's right up there next to Ezekiel 25:19, right? Like I feel like this one's only a rung or two down from that, from Pulp Fiction. Yeah. So I want to tie that to when we get to the courtroom scene and they deliver it for the final time. And I think that courtroom scene is brilliant.
It's so good. It's so well done. I see why they did it, but my only gripe with this scene is that they take off the masks. And I know that they're announcing themselves to the world. Don't get me wrong. But the reality is that if they want to actually be active and go carry out this mission, they need to be kind of anonymous so that they don't get caught. And so, I understand where it's supposed to be this announcement of like this fucking warning of like clean up your shit or we're coming for you. And so it really lands and it's beautifully done, and the way they even handle the hostages is gentle, but it's warning. And but it mixes up with me of like they would find them in 3 minutes flat, you know what I mean?
Because well, I guess taken the thought is we see that they have done enough of all the positive things we've said about the brothers throughout the movie and how charming and likable and how they're doing the right things. They've won over the police department at this point. Everyone in the yeah. Boston police is like helping them commit this crime, yeah. this atrocity. But they
I just
like
love how they
right
like throw
reasons.
The guns over the metal detector too. They're just like, we don't give a shit. We're coming in. You
yeah,
know,
it's a little loophole, guys. If you ever need to get through a metal detector, just throw
yeah,
your gun
yeah,
over.
Just
top
throw it
of
over.
It.
You're no big deal.
But like we see that, and I guess you can kind of interpret it as sort of a Robin Hood situation where it's like no one would ever turn Robin Hood in because they think what he's doing is good and positive. So maybe it's kind of like that. And we do see that they're kind of on the lam at the end. I don't think they're staying in Boston for much longer. They're probably going to be on the move. We don't get. And that's,
I feel like the implication is they did the thing in Boston that they needed to do. And now they're going to, now they're going to move on to the next one. But I do think that I don't think they're universally beloved though. And I think the credit scenes tell us that too, of like, it is divisive still.
How did you feel about, I feel like the courtroom scene is such a high. It is like such a climax, and it is just the most badass moment in the film. I love that line of, we'll send you to whatever God you wish. That is, again, fucking mm-hmm. cold. But after that, we get the single sort of two lines of dialogue in the hotel where he's like, how far are we going to take this? We get that little, and then it fades out. And then we cut to the news broadcast, and that carries us to the closing credits, right? Like the credits start rolling throughout these interviews, and it's just, we get it. These are complex characters. Not everyone agrees with the morality.
Yeah.
I'll also say some of the worst actors in the film are in those news interviews, which kind of makes me roll my eyes in like the last 5 minutes, which isn't great. But I feel like the ending fizzles a little bit for me after how awesome the courtroom scene is to get those two things tacked on. Like, what's your take on that?
Yes and no. I mean, I think I see what you're saying, but I also think this, it is such a high. It is totally this, we've had a bunch of climaxes here is what I would say. We've had a lot of climaxes and it's kind of hard to come down from that. And where are you taking the story? What is the end game? You're not going to show them get arrested. You're not going to show them killed. Like, that's not the point of this story. Right. So where do you take them other than imply that they are then free to keep going? And I think that's what that hotel scene is trying to do. Like, are we committing to the bit, Dad? Yep, we are. Cool. We're going to do it. And you're not supposed to see the next step explicitly, or at least that's the way that I read it. But I kind of get this implication. It almost reminds me of like vigilante, like comic book kind of things of, you do have these people who are going to be reacting almost like Spider-Man. You brought up Spider-Man earlier. It's like a Spider-Man thing too of, there's news reactions to this superhero, these superheroes or these vigilantes, or think Batman or whatever. There's always these strong reactions to what they are out there doing. And I think that's the implication here of, like, they're going to go off and keep doing these things. And it's going to continue to be this divisive situation for people who encounter it.
Yeah. First off, I have to give myself credit because it took everything in me not to make a joke when you said we've had lots of climaxes. I was like,
I am proud of you because I thought that too. I was like,
I'm an adult.
He's about to make
it. So I'm going to continue into my next line of logic. I do like, there's one thing that I don't know why it didn't occur to me to now, but it always also seemed a little strange to me that in that scene, is it Connor? Yeah, Connor. He delivers that line of, how far are we going to take this, Dad, with really hesitation and kind of like fear and a little bit of, I don't want to call it regret, but it's just like, we did some fucked up stuff. And like, how far do we need? I do like that adds another level to the characters, I think.
I agree.
Of, they're not just superhero vigilantes that are like, we're going to kill it. They are carrying a debt of the atrocities that they're committing within their conscience. And it is something that's going to continue to weigh on them. And I think that's why Il Duce's line, their father, makes so much more sense of just like, how far, it's not about how far, it's are you able to keep doing this, thinking that you're doing the right thing, knowing that you're taking lives?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because we talked about earlier, it can be this self-contained story because it is so well done, but it does open up a can of worms of, do I want more to this story? And I think you do want to some degree to know a little bit more about their dad. And I think the reason that there is this fear in Connor's voice is, he was locked up because he's incredibly dangerous. Like, we know that. We got to see that. Even if they don't yet know that, we got to see that. And I think he's questioning, like, what is this person's motives? Because our motives, as we see earlier in the film, is what we think is literally the Holy Spirit coming down and telling them, you have to do this. They're waking up with this mission. They are doing it almost against their will, but they are trusting that gut. They don't entirely know what his motivation is. And I think so, as a result, they're a little bit scared of him. But I think maybe also part of the implication is that he maybe woke up with the same mission, right? This is a family prayer.
That's
this
what
is a
we assume,
business.
Right? Yeah. He
right,
created
we,
that prayer. So,
right.
Well, and maybe the dad didn't, but like they said, the father's father, all that.
The
so this
family
is
did. And is this in their, you know, is this their history? Is this their legacy? But because of this disconnect between them and their dad and their mom and what have you, I don't know that they're connecting those dots yet, is what I'm saying. And I think that, but I think that's an interesting, I think it's an interesting way to end it of like, where could this go? I also think it's okay to not get the answer to that.
Yeah. I mean, you talking about like, maybe it's just in their blood and this is something every generation of them helps click, again, ties back to my superhero theory. So if we get the McManus brothers in the next Avengers, don't be surprised. We heard it here first.
Yeah, obviously. That's the next phase of the story, for sure. For sure.
Not shooting Thanos in the back of the head.
Don't get it twisted. That's not the next phase. This is the superhero of it all. Oh, well, anyways, I think all that to say, like, this is so much fun. I just fucking love this movie. Yeah. So what is your rating?
I'm going to be fully transparent and say this is one where I am not going to be objective at all. I think this movie's a blast. I mean, there's definitely things that are not perfect about it. And I think you said IMDb rating was what, like a 7.4 or something 7. Like that. It's well regarded, and I'm going to go a little higher than that just because of personal preference. If I really enjoy this, and even after, you know, how 25 years of watching it every 4 to 5 years, I still really enjoy it. And there's not a ton I would change. So I'm going to go 8.5. I feel like most of my action choices, or like what most of the action movies we cover this month, are probably going to fall in like the 7 to 8 range. But this one's just so awesome for me. So I'm going to go 8.5.
Yeah, I'm going to go 9. Like, I just have a good fucking time watching this movie. Like, that was my gut check. I put it in there earlier and I was like watching it. But I said out loud to nobody and also to Skylar, I fucking love this movie. Like, 3 different times while I was watching the movie. And I was just like, I just fucking love this movie. And I just can't help it. Like, there are some teeny tiny holes. But I think they are. They're teeny tiny. And the script is so tight. And the production is so strong. And the performances are so strong. And Willem Dafoe is a fucking legend. And I just have the best time watching this movie. And I think that even the problematic things that we talked about are very situational. And even now, even though it's hard to hear them and it's like very uncomfortable, like, they make sense in the context in which they are presented for the most part. And so I can write those things off and kind of move on and still have a really good time. So yeah.
We've said before of, I think sometimes when I rate films, it's just, hey, does this accomplish what it sets out to do goal-wise? And for a movie like this, we know what it's trying to do. It just wants to be a romp. It wants to be fun. It wants to make you laugh. I think it succeeds at all of those things. Like I said,
100%.
I would add something to the father's storyline just to bridge that gap. I might have another scene where they get captured. And some of that's probably on deleted scenes in the DVD anyway. But 8.5, like, I just, it's so fucking good. It does everything it tries to do.
So good. If you haven't seen it in a minute, give it a rewatch. Yep. You're going to have a good time for sure. All right, homies. Well, thank you for joining us on this one. This was a great time. As you can tell, we really thoroughly enjoyed it. Come back next week for another fun entry that we are actually going to do with our friends over at Prime Cut. You have heard them before. Remember them? You've heard them before. They're such a great time. We're going to have them back, or they're going to have us back. I don't really know
kind of crossover episode.
Some kind of crossover something, but we're going to talk about Atomic Blonde. Which I haven't seen in a hot minute. Oh, you haven't seen it?
I haven't seen it, period.
Yeah. I have it. I don't know if it's streaming or whatever, but I have it if you need it. But anyway, it's a good time. It's interesting.
Aren't the directors like the same people who did John Wick or some other big action franchise?
I think it's the same producers, maybe. Okay. Yeah, it's a similar vibe. But again, I haven't seen it. I do own it, but I haven't seen it in a really long time. So it's kind of a fun revisit for me. But I think they suggested it to us and we were like, ooh, this will fit right in.
Yeah.
So super excited to have them back. But in the meantime,
follow us on our socials, Instagram, TikTok. You can watch video from this on YouTube. You can also watch video on Spotify. And then always feel free to reach out. We drink and we watch things pod@gmail.com. So any feedback you have, any suggestions, anything we messed up, or any more information you want to give us, you know, maybe we need to do a mailbag episode at some point soon. So anything you guys want to know, we'll see.
To be fair, they haven't been mean to us in a while, so it's probably not a very interesting mailbag. But but yeah, I mean, feel free. Get your hits in now, and we'll do a read back of them later. But for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.